The approach would be like this. The first question that we dealt with was, first of all, we saw that there was no comparison. Okay? And now we saw that the comparison was in every aspect of the comparison, and the first question was that we dealt with the spread. Okay? All right. Because we took friend, because friend was in itself contradictory between insult and friend. I mean, that seemed to be like self-contradictory. It's like a square circle. Like a insult a friend, that's not a friend, right? So therefore, we took that question because there was no clarity on the word friend. So, okay, so therefore, that was the second step. And the certain, in other words, like this, you'll find that there are certain words that my ego doesn't allow me to investigate. Words like friend, everybody knows what a friend is. How could you investigate friend? I know what justice is, I know what kindness is. You see, very, very simple words, which people, like, they just take for granted. Usually you'll find that those are the, you'll find terrible, terrible contradictions in those, and that's where it'll lead you to a search of some basic terms that you use every day. And so therefore we have to straighten out friend and change our definition of friend. Like most of us, a friend is somebody I like, somebody I spend a lot of time with, somebody I miss, somebody that I call, but we're not defining friend that way. That's a description. All those terms, all those feelings are a description of the person I identify with, you see. And therefore, once we defined it, became a different view of friend. Then once we saw the problem with identification, then naturally you wanted to know the cure, right? So to know the cure, you have to know what is the opposite side that we had to deal with. Why would a person be kind to a poor person, right? So that we said there were certain incorrect views. And we said, but despite the fact that there's incorrect views, the question is, why do I hate a poor person, you see? In other words, if there is hatred to a certain group of people, there must be a reason why everybody hates, or most people hate, that type of person. So we have to define that hatred. Definitely we're going to have to find it in psychology. That's a psychological thing. So once we found that, so that's when we really saw it, that we were able to see the rest. Okay? So and the only thing I could tell you practically, in going over in method, is to first get all the contradictions. Then to a certain extent, I mean, not to a certain extent, to a very large extent, you have to rely on your intuition which question comes first. I mean, you can't tell till after the process, because if you take the wrong question first, then you don't have the basis. You have to know which just comes prior to the other. And now, since you don't have the answer, so you cannot know which one comes first. So the only thing you could rely on is your intuition, and through years of practice, you straighten out that intuition. But right now, you have no choice. You must rely on your own intuition and slowly but surely straighten it out. Okay? And not to be afraid of redefining terms that you accepted, that you understood from childhood on, to don't be afraid to redefine it according to the verse. And if you have the courage to do that, in other words, it's courage, because you're going against everything. You have to say that I made a mistake from childhood on. Everything I accept about friendship, my understanding of friendship, is wrong. Like, that's a part of me. What is a friend? I mean, I always lived a certain way and related a certain way, and now I have to say it's wrong. That's why I say it's courage. In other words, certain simple words that you have to not be afraid of to look at and reevaluate based, and let your question be your guide. Let the question be the guide. You cannot go by the order of the verse. You must, because sometimes there's just a sense that I should start with the second half. Well, sometimes in class somebody starts with one half and I might start with the other half. And they might be right or I might be right. You understand? It's intuition at that point. It's very hard to tell till you're through with the process which approach was correct. Okay? And I just want to give you one more piece of advice. Don't work by these rules that I've told you. What do I mean? Because that will only confuse you. Because, in other words, what you do, like for instance, when you drive, if you thought about all the things that you're doing when you drive, you'll get into an accident, right? Because if you think of, let's say, for instance, I remember I learned to drive with the clutch. I mean, you have to put your foot in the clutch, and you have to let out the clutch a certain amount. Then you have to put on the gas, and then you have to know when to put on the gas, and then to put the foot on the brake. You have to think of the clutch, you know what I mean? All those things are confusing. It must become second nature. So therefore, I say, think with your natural mind, and let your own intuition guide you. Then when you make a mistake, then your mind is now thinking about the mistake that you made. Like we are going over the process. We're defining the process. Once we're finished with that subject of defining the process, that also should affect the way you think. So now when you go back, don't use this process, but the fact that you studied the process, that should have affected you, and now when you go back, you start again, you just allow your mind to work. But now your mind might be slightly trained, and if you keep doing this 100 times, 200 times, 1,000 times, then after a while your intuition picks up where to go and how to go, so then your intuition is more in line. It's just a matter of practice. Let's put it this way. Your natural intuition, I can't give you better. Either you're born an Einstein or you're not an Einstein. That's it. But what we can do is guide your intuition to know where to go naturally instead of going in the wrong direction. Through training, you could go in the correct direction. In other words, the type of question you would want to ask during class, if let's say you made a statement and it was a mistake, then later, when we see that, why it was a mistake and how it worked out, then you ask, what logical mistake did I make? So then when we define it logically, that'll have a big effect on your intuition in the future, whether to go on the correct path or not. You understand? It'll affect you. So there's two things. There's thinking of the subject that you're working on. Don't think of methodology. When you've made mistakes, then go back to question that mistakes. Now your mind is on methodology, you see? Then once you clarify the methodology, forget the methodology, unless you want to review it at some point. But then when you're studying a new subject, don't think of the methodology, but think of the subject. If you try to think of the methodology when you're thinking of the subject, you'll only get confused that it's not a real guide. It will not help you at all. Okay? So your mind is always on one thing, either the subject or the mind where it made a mistake, which is a different subject. But once we get a method or what was wrong with it, don't think about it on the next step. If you make the same mistake again, then let's analyze it again, see how it worked in this area, and that will help correct it. But it's a different type of question when you want to correct your intuition or your mistakes. And that is when you think incorrectly and say, what was my mistake? Right, it says like this. We're up to verse 23. It says, in all toil there'll be gain, but talk of the lips brings only loss. In the first half of the verse, it says, in all toil there'll be a benefit. It doesn't say whether you'll be successful. In other words, it seems to be talking about the toil itself is a benefit. You see? And the question on the second half, what is
words of the lips is only for loss. What is that? The second half means that where you speak and don't act is only for a loss, okay? That seems to be obvious, right? Right? Okay. So that seems to be obvious. So that's the question. Right, so anyway, but the verse is saying that any when you're working, okay, when you're toiling, doesn't mean just busy work. It means work where you want to, where it's practical, where you're supposed to do something. The work itself is a benefit, and if you just talk about it, you say, that's a loss in itself. The question that we have to ask is, why is the toil in itself a benefit? Usually the benefit is when you toil and you're successful. We're saying the toil itself is a benefit, and the question is, what is the benefit in the toil itself? Like we said before, toil is not just busy work. It means work that is for the purpose of some practical end. You're just doing busy work, I mean, that's just a waste. I mean, it must be for some benefit, but we're saying the benefit, even if you're not successful, he says all toil is for a benefit. The people are saying that by Torah, the process itself is not the benefit. Yeah, that's by Torah. The study of Torah itself is a benefit, because the mind is working and you're thinking and you're developing. Even if you don't come to a conclusion, there are benefits in thinking. Here we're talking about work itself, that I'm working for a certain goal. I want to make a living, and I'm working towards that goal. The work itself is a benefit. In other words, the reason why I work is for results. So what's the benefit in the work itself? In other words, the pasuk doesn't seem to be talking about any type of gain. People want to say that I'll learn from my mistakes, I'll learn my job better, I'll strengthen my skills by doing it. We're talking about, I mean, this is all true. These are all true, but it seems to be toiling itself where there is no benefit from the toil. Okay? The work itself seems to be no benefit. I mean, all those things are true. There are benefits, those type of things, but I'm saying even without those types, it seems to be the toil itself. Something else seems to be here. They want to say that you learn humility because you recognize that the results are not in your hands, so you have to accept reality for what it is when you're not successful. And that is definitely a possibility, what the pasuk is talking about. What the commentary seems to say is that it's talking about the removal of laziness, that a person is not lazy. In other words, if people only work for results, you see, for some type of benefit, you see, so then they do it for the benefit. But again, if it's rational to do, in other words, I'm not talking about an irrational type of job. It's rational to do the job, and you're trying to bring about a certain result. It doesn't matter whether you get the result. Of course, it's good if you get the result. But the pasuk is talking about the work itself is a benefit. So one is humility. But one is that that you're developing and you're perfecting that part of you, part of you that the opposite of laziness, the energetic part, the zrizus, the working for because you see the in other words, the work itself, the removal of laziness. Okay, so there are two possibilities that the pasuk is talking about. One is, like Max said, it's a acceptance of reality, or two is that you're not lazy. In other words, you accept the fact, the benefit that, in other words, you realize that this was the right thing to do. In other words, a lot of people feel good only when they get the results. They don't feel good about the work. In other words, you could put, how many people were prepared for a test and then failed the test, say, well, I did the right thing and I did all the work, at least I'm not lazy. Well, I have to accept reality that I don't have a good memory even though I studied, or something, whatever, like that. Nobody says that. Most people say if they get the if they get the result, they get the grade, then it's good. If they don't get the grade, it's bad. We're saying that you could look at the work itself and say that's also a benefit. The work itself becomes, in and of itself, a benefit. It's a different way of looking at the your work, that you could see the benefit and you learn to accept, look, this is what life is. Sometimes you're successful, you can't be perfect. Sometimes you're successful, sometimes you're not, or you might have a certain weakness that you have to accept reality. But the thing is that definitely, look, I could accept the state that I'm in, that I'm not a lazy person, and I did the work, I did that which was right to do. Or I learned that that reality is such that sometimes you can't always make it a reality. It's not always success. But there is a different view of working. Not all the time is the results in your hands, and so therefore the only credit you can take is the work. I mean, that would be really reality, to realize that all you could do is do the work. Results are not in my hands. Results are in God's hands. I mean, people told me they tried to get here this morning and they were all late. It was not their fault. So they always did the right thing. Insofar as they're concerned, they did the right thing. Okay? So the second half, what is the second half saying? In other words, the second half is where you talk about it and you don't do. Question is, how is that in relationship to the first half? What's the opposites here? In other words, the loss is not that they didn't get the results. There are psukim that talk about that laziness, you don't get the results. But there's a loss inherent in not doing the work, because you're training yourself to be lazy. You're training yourself to go in the wrong direction. You see? That's bad. In other words, this pasuk is giving us a different outlook on life than the way we usually look at it. Usually we look at it for instance, here in school, we look at it for grades. If I could take an easier course to get the better grade, so then I feel I accomplished something because I got the good grade. But if I do that, I'm training myself not to work, take life easy and not to work, just for the grade. You see, that is also a danger. But people don't look at life that way. So the pasuk is telling us to look at life in a very different way. We're doing verse 24, and it says, "The crown of the wise is their wealth, and the foolishness of the fool is their foolishness." Rashi says that instead of the word foolish, you should translate it as damage. So he says the foolishness of the fool damages him, causes damage or harm. Okay? In other words, literally the verse says the foolishness of the fool is his foolishness. What it means is the foolishness of the fool causes his damage. That's how Rashi learns. Okay? So that's okay, but the big question is, in other words, the second half, according to Rashi, is that damage is caused to the fool by his foolishness. So therefore, it does make sense. We might not understand how it works, but at least there is a statement here. Before, there was no statement. And so the question on the second half is that the damage damage of the fool is his foolishness. What's new? That's the whole book of Proverbs is about that. So what is he adding here? Okay? But the problem is on the first half, it says the crown of the wise is their wealth. I mean, that's really, I wouldn't say that. I would say the crown of the wise is their wisdom. You understand? Not their wealth. Okay, that seems to be saying
You understand it's hard to... And what is the word crown? Crown is the metaphor here. Then what quality of crown is he talking about? Okay. One person wants to say that a crown is that it's an achievement, like you're successful. And he says the success of the wise is his wealth. Okay? So the question is, I mean, that is, if I'm going to give him a crown, I give him a crown of wisdom. So Yaakov wants to say that it means that because of his wisdom, he has wealth. Okay? So you'll ask me, you'll know there are wise people that are not wealthy. There are two reasons why a wise person would not be wealthy. One reason is outside factors. Like we've said many times, Mishle is discussing not the outside factors, but because of you, what you did, because of your wisdom, what you could get. So insofar as wisdom is concerned, you should be able to get wealth also. You should have wisdom and you should be able to have wealth. The only thing is sometimes there's outside factors, which there's nothing you could do. So therefore, if it's out of your hand, so then you're right. So then, but it's not because of his lack of wisdom that he doesn't have money. It's because of the situation that it's impossible to have money. Okay? So that would not take away his crown. But there is another reason why a person would not have wealth. Let's say a person has enough energy to either gain wealth or to gain wisdom. There's a medrash by Shlomo, and God said, you have a choice. Do you want wealth or wisdom? And God said, I'll give you wisdom. Shlomo asked for wisdom. So God said, because you asked for wisdom, I'll also give you the wealth. Okay? In other words, it could mean the medrash means exactly what we're saying, that as a result of your wisdom, you will get wealth. But however, if I only have the energy for one or the other, like Shlomo answered, his answer would be that I would choose wisdom over wealth, so then he cannot have wealth because he chose wisdom. So therefore, you really can't say, it's hard to say, that the crown of wisdom is wealth, because that's not true. Because sometimes a person will choose wisdom because he doesn't have the energy to put in both to gain wisdom and to gain wealth. Some people have the ability to do both. If they have the ability to do both, then of course, why shouldn't you have it both? But if you don't have the ability to do both, then the better thing is to choose wisdom over the wealth. So therefore, it's not always the crown of wisdom. The crown of wisdom is not gaining wealth all the time. Sometimes the crown is that you decided to keep wisdom even though you won't be able to get wealth because you don't have the energy to do both. You only have enough energy to get one or the other. So therefore we want to say that the answer, the subject of the verse is how you use your money. How you use your money shows the crown, who is living a foolish life and who is living an intelligent life. In other words, the intelligent person, first of all, because he has wealth, so he'll use his time to learn, and what he'll use his money for, to help people and to do justice with, while the foolish person will spend his time doing foolish things, like going to ball games, and playing tiddlywinks, okay, and doing harmful things. On the contrary, since he has the money, the Ibn Ezra says that he'll do a foolishness she'en kamohu, that there's no equal to it. In other words, because now that he has the money, he has the ability to do unbelievable harmful things. So therefore, he will destroy, having money, he'll destroy himself with that, you see, because he has the ability to carry out his foolishness, and that will totally destroy him. But the tzaddik, by the way, this answer was given by the Ralban. The tzaddik, on the other hand,
The tzaddik, on the other hand, will use his money. So in other words, you see the... In other words, why is it the crown? Because you can't see wisdom. But you could see the usage of money, how a person uses his money. So when you see how a person uses his money, then you see whether he's wise or foolish. You see? So the pasuk is saying how to recognize, in other words, if he's foolish, he'll totally self-destruct. His destruction will be worse than a poor person. It's really just the opposite of the world. World that says they're jealous of rich people, even the poor people, they want to be like the... On the contrary, if you're a fool, you're better off being poor because you can't do such... You can't carry out all your foolishness and totally destroy yourself to such a bad extent. So therefore, it's better if a foolish person doesn't have money. But if you're an intelligent person, the crown that you could see the greatness of the person, you could see the greatness of the person is through his wealth. How he uses it, that he uses it for good things. When we started out, we didn't know what the second half of the verse was talking about. In fact, the question was, it's so universal that's the whole book of Mishlei says the second half. That was the question. But after we explained the first half, we realized that the subject is how to use wealth, so then we could apply that to the second half, and the damage to the fool is where he has a lot of money, then the damage is very different than a fool that's poor, because he can't damage himself as much. He doesn't have the tools to totally destroy himself like the wealthy man does. It's true that everybody has the tools to damage themselves, but some situations are worse than others. You could do more damage in certain situations. We're saying that wealth is that type of situation where if you live a foolish life, you could do more damage to yourself because you could carry out your fantasies. Since you can act out your fantasies, so therefore the damage will be greater. In other words, let's say a person thinks about being a Hitler, being a tyrant, and he daydreams about that. But he doesn't have the ability, he doesn't have the situation, so the guy wastes his time daydreaming. But if he actually lived the life of Hitler, that's totally destructive. He just totally destroyed himself. You see what I mean? So therefore, the fact is that if you have the tools, you can destroy yourself to a much greater level than if you don't have the physical tools. So therefore, it's the same stupidity, but one, the situation, you could carry it out to a worse level than and more destructive than the person that doesn't have that potential. In other words, a person, before he should think about wealth, the first thing he should do, like Shlomo HaMelech, when he was asked if he had a choice whether he wants wealth or wisdom, he should choose wisdom. A person should see that's the best way of life. But it's only after you have the wisdom, then wealth is a good thing, because then you can carry out your good intentions, the intentions to benefit people. But if you don't have wisdom, then you can't. Then you will destroy yourself. Okay, we're up to verse 25, and it says like this. It says, "A true witness saves lives, but a person that speaks deception." And one that speaks deception saves only a man of deceit. Okay? Yes. Okay, once again, a true witness saves lives, but a spouter of deception, person that speaks deceptions, saves only a man of deceit. Hey, the Metzudas David says like this. The Metzudas David says that if the guy is innocent, in other words, the guy that gives the true testimony, so if the guy is innocent, so he saves him from punishment. if the guy is guilty, so then he's saving people that would be destroyed by the guilty guy. Right? So, in other words, either way he's saving lives if he makes the guy guilty or innocent. If it's innocent, then he's saving the defendant because he shouldn't be punished. The guy is guilty, then he has to be stopped so that he shouldn't hurt others. So either way, he's saving people. So therefore, a false witness will get the wrong... In other words, a false witness will free the guilty and save the condemn the innocent. That's what it means, false, right? So therefore, he will be harming people. He only protects the people that are deceitful. Okay? Now the question is, well, yeah, this is true, but why do I need King Solomon to tell me this? In other words, the pasuk doesn't seem to be saying the consequence to the person that lied. Okay? Doesn't seem to be giving that consequence, the pasuk. Okay? So therefore, it's just stating a fact. It just seems to be stating a fact of what the benefit is in general, insofar as justice is concerned, and insofar as justice is concerned, were you benefiting justice or harming justice? So the question is, yeah, well, of course, and this is an obvious thing. This is very obvious, so why is he telling me this? There is a philosophy of we don't tell to the authorities, you know, we protect our own. And if somebody did wrong, so we protect them. Like many times students, even if a kid is wrong and the teacher wants to punish him, all the kids somehow come out against the teacher and protect the student. Okay? So the thing is that there is a certain emotion there, okay? There's a certain view of that I am protecting. In other words, it's a certain sense of justice that I'm protecting a certain person. I protect my own, you see? And I look at that as a system of justice. What the pasuk is saying is don't make a mistake about that system. That's just, in other words, it's a narrow view. It's not the overall view of justice. I just take care of my own. It could be my family. It could be my friends. Whatever it is, we take care of our own, and we don't tell on our people. That's a certain view of justice. When a person does that, he feels that he's living according to a system of justice. Okay? What King Solomon is saying, that the overall picture of justice in general should not work that way. The overall picture of justice should be just say the truth. Whatever it is, you must live by the law. Okay? So therefore, I mean, we're talking in a just society where it's a just government. I'm not talking by an unjust government. But in a just government, so therefore you must stick by the law. That is the ultimate justice. But however, there is an incorrect justice that people seem to think. That's the second half of the pasuk, where I just take care of my own. Okay? That is not justice. We'll take the next two psukim, okay? It says like this. The fear of the Lord is a powerful stronghold, and for his children it will be a shelter. Then the second verse, 27, is fear of Hashem is the source of life, to turn one away from the snares of death. There are four statements here, okay? First of all, fear of Hashem is a powerful stronghold, that's one. For his children, it will be a shelter. Fear of Hashem is the source of life, for the purpose to turn away from the snares of death. We'll take the second pasuk first. because it seems to be telling us something essential about fear of God. It says the fear of God is the source of life. Okay, and to turn away from the traps of death. Okay, question is, how are we defining the fear of death? So the question is, how is fear of the Lord? What does it mean, the source of life? Fear of God is the source of life. What is the definition of fear of God, that it is the source of life? The fear of God has two definitions. There are three types of fear, okay? One type of fear, we would say, in Hebrew they use the term yira, fear, but in English we translate it awe. That awe comes about as a result of your knowledge of God. When you see the knowledge of God, you see that the source of all knowledge in this world is God, so you're drawn to the source of all knowledge via the knowledge. That's awe. The fear that King Solomon is talking about is consequences. What he means by fear, in other words, this, you might not shake you might not be shaking when you look both ways when you cross the street, but the reason why you cross the street is so that you should protect yourself, so you should not get hurt. It's really a certain type of fear, okay? That is, in other words, why don't you cross the street blindfolded? Why don't you walk in front of a truck? Because you're afraid of dying. I'm sorry. You did not cross the street out of fear, okay, every track. The reason why you look both ways when you cross the street is because of fear, okay? So therefore, I mean, you might not feel fear, but you are afraid of death. You are afraid of getting hurt, okay? Then there's a third type of fear, a psychological fear, like I have a vague fear, I'm afraid of God. Somehow I'm afraid of God. That there is, that the Torah doesn't seem to mention any place. Whenever they define fear of God, it is not that type of fear, that just a psychological type of fear out of the fear of the unknown, or fear of some power, fear of something that you just vague thing, it's just a vague thing that I'm afraid of. You say, that is not what the Torah has in mind. What the Torah has in mind is when it talks about fear, and that's what Mishlei is all about, the whole book of Mishlei, is when it talks about fear of God, it's talking about fear of consequences. Okay? That you are careful for any action that you do now, you look at the consequences, and that's how you make your decision whether you should do the act. Okay? Now, by life, when he says that it is the source of life, the Meiri says there are different levels of life. In other words, there's a good life, a happy life. Practically, you have the benefits of the physical world, you see? That's also part of, when it talks about life, it doesn't only mean life or death. It does mean life or death, it protects you from death, but it also gives you in other words, there's existence and there's a way of life. Existence, you could exist and be unhappy, but a way of life gives you the enrichment of life. That's what the fear of God does. Fear of God gives you, takes away the consequences and trains you to think how to get the best out of life, okay? So therefore, the second verse is explained. He says, it gives you, he's the source of life, which means it's the good life and life itself, and turns away from the traps of death. The trap of death is because King Solomon, at the beginning of this book, he wrote a metaphor for the nature of this book. And the metaphor was that a bird sees the bait but doesn't see the trap behind it. In other words, what you see is a certain desire, immediate desire, and you don't notice the trap behind it. That is the That is what the book is about, that it trains you to be careful of the immediate, which draws you immediately and blinds you to the consequences afterwards. That is fear of God, and that's what the Pasuk 27 is talking about. Now we have to go back to 26. It means fear of God. It means that the physical world which was made by God, has certain rules and regulations. And if you live by that system, that God created the physical world, you will have a good life. If you do not live by that system, then you will suffer, have a bad life, suffer, and have consequences, and even shorten your life. That's what the pasuk is basically saying. Okay? So now it's really the first pasuk says that the fear of God is a powerful stronghold. It's like a fortress around you. It's like a fortress to protect you. So what's the metaphor of fortress? The stronghold is the wisdom that you get from, like a book like Mishlei from Proverbs. The stronghold is the wisdom of how to think correctly so that you don't get the consequences. Okay? Now, once you live that life, then naturally your children will pick that up. In other words, naturally your children start thinking, if that's the way you think in life, then your children will pick that up. And when they pick that up, they'll learn how to protect themselves and how to live a life of that type of life. If they, you understand. So therefore it says, that's why the Pasuk 25 says, it's a stronghold for the person that has it, and it will also protect the children. But first of all, it will protect children in two ways. One, the way you make decisions about your children, that'll be protection, because you'll be able to protect your child that way. And two, your child will pick up, naturally at a young age, children pick up what their parents do. Their children will pick up this idea, this way of thinking, so they will have a better life. Even though they didn't actually study the book, they already have the start. They study, then they themselves will become that way. They themselves will have fear of the Lord. But like this, they'll be trained to a certain extent on their own, even without studying Torah. And yeah, but the verse would be the same thing. He is gracious, he who helps anybody, which should be. The point is that somebody wants to answer like this, that in other words, like you're taking more from the poor man, is if you just want to answer that the curse of why if you rob the poor, why that disgrace says, even as it says, that the thing is that the what's happening, that is injustice. This act that he's doing is not because he's denying what you're doing. Second verse, it tells the consequences. In his trouble, the wicked one is saying that the person that robs from the poor thinks they're the champion. The proof that they feel that God is not aware and God does not deal with the poor is because they don't rob from the poor. Okay, we're still in chapter 14 and we're doing verse 32. Okay? Of the righteous in God, who the his is, whose death it is that in his wickedness, but he who trusts in his death. Okay? The question is, who's his death? What Doug wants to say is, one is the possibility that he has the is that he'll trust in God that thing. If you die, in other words, in Mishlei, if you die, death is just the ultimate punishment for living an incorrect life. But however, if you live out your life, that is the... So therefore, if you die, young a terrible life because you lived an incorrect life in your life. So then it's a consequence. But if you, the tzaddik has trust in his own death. That he has trust in God because of his death, meaning the wicked. How do we deal with that? If we and not being bothered by the wicked, expect if he dies, he might have fear. The question is his punishment in this world or is his punishment in today, that because he's out of line with reality, he has to be in conflict. Okay, that's your question, Doug. I understand he's in conflict. This is when they do their evil things or they get away with it, they have accomplished what their desire is. They're satisfying their desire. Satisfied. Okay? And if you tell me, when a wicked person lives out to ask a question against God's justice for no reason, that's evil. He doesn't intervene, so then the wicked person could live a... physically, he did the things that, so the thing was, friend, if he doesn't do, like when Hitler, when his ability comes in and says, you are not able to escape, that they're totally destroyed by that. And by Bilam, seems to have a certain recognition experience. Somebody tells you something, but makes you feel bad. It doesn't matter if it's good or bad. Once you feel bad, you designate that what the person said is evil, and you're angry with the person. So therefore, you only make decisions about people how you are affected. If you only make decisions by how you are affected, then you can't really know God. You can only know God. You must know God objectively to recognize that there really is a God and to understand how God operates. Okay? So therefore, a person by definition who's selfish would be impossible for him to have a knowledge of God because he's totally involved in the self. And if that is true, so then the one who robs the poor, he's worse than the person that helps the poor, because the person that helps the poor for selfish reasons, where he gets some benefit out of it, there is a good. He is doing the correct act, and therefore it can help him, can benefit him for doing the correct act. But the ultimate is where the person recognizes the need of the poor. Where you recognize the need of the poor, so then that means you're able to look at life objectively and look outside yourself. And therefore, once you can look at life outside yourself objectively, then you can relate to God. Okay? That is the first pasuk. So that answers the question. Why we took particular poor person, that particular mitzvah. I mean, it really could have said, why not robbing? It could have said, why, if you rob somebody, you're disgracing God. You see? Because the thing is really when you rob somebody, it's also you don't recognize their needs. But however, by a poor person, it's a catastrophe. I mean, you can't even understand that a person doesn't have what to eat. And you're taking the food out of his mouth. I mean, if you can't recognize that, and you can't have any feeling towards that you're doing, you only think in terms of your needs, so that's a person that's impossible to know God. It's impossible to know God. That level. Therefore, in his trouble, the wicked one is cast off from God, meaning he'll get the consequences. He'll get the consequences of his actions. Doesn't say exactly what the consequence, but throughout Mishlei, we discuss where somebody doesn't live in line with reality, then they will get consequences. Right. Now it says, but he who takes shelter in him, in God, remained righteous in death. Okay, so the Ibn Ezra has two interpretations. It doesn't say whose death. It says, will remain righteous in his death. Okay? So one is the wicked person's death, okay? When by death it means a catastrophe. If a catastrophe happens to a wicked person, so then you're able to see the system, okay? And especially if you know the causes for these consequences, you understand by studying through Mishlei and through different areas of Torah, you understand the consequences of how these consequences come about, that's strengthens your trust in God. Okay? That so strengthens your trust in God. So therefore, in that way, in his death, okay, in other words, when the wicked are cast off from God, when he has troubles and consequences, okay, so then you remain righteous, okay? In other words, it gives you security in that your way of life is the correct way when you see the people living incorrectly and they are destroyed. Okay, that's one way the Ibn Ezra learns. Another way he learns in his death and the death of the tzaddik, and he brings the case of Chizkiyo, where he was given the second chance. He was supposed to die and he was given a second chance. God intervened and gave him a second chance to live longer, which means that God, that this is the quality that you need to relate to God. When you have that quality, that you recognize the needs of the poor, then you can reach the level, then you can be at the level where God can relate to you. And even though you're in trouble, God will intervene in your troubles and help you out. We're up to verse 33, and it says like this. Wisdom will reside in an understanding heart, but within fools it will be publicized. The pasuk is talking about people that have wisdom. They have knowledge. A lot of people, in other words, we're not talking about the second half. He's not talking about a fool that's ignorant of knowledge. He's not ignorant. He's an intelligent person that has knowledge, that can talk knowledge, have discussions. But the difference between the first half and the second half is the motive for the knowledge. The first half recognizes the value of knowledge, and therefore he will only talk about it only in situations where it's proper and correct. Not every place is a place to talk about the wisdom, and not to everybody should you talk wisdom. So therefore, in the first half, we're talking about a person that recognizes the true value of wisdom. The second half of the pasuk, he has wisdom, but however, his purpose is for self-aggrandizement, so therefore he shows very clearly that he does have wisdom. So you see that there are two different, in other words, we're talking about two people that could have the same amount of knowledge. The only thing is the motive, what drives them for knowledge is different. The question is, what's wrong with sharing knowledge? I'm not saying that it's wrong to share knowledge. And there's sometimes you should tell over knowledge, and sometimes you should not. I mean, there's certain places where it's proper and there's certain places where it's not. The fool is the person that just is interested in publicizing. That's all it is. That's his motive. And therefore it shows up that he'll speak to people that have no interest. But he just wants to show that he's a wise person. Okay? A calm heart is a person that just has to make decisions based on the facts around them. Okay? In other words, I don't need that much money to satisfy myself. But however, if I have to compete with people, then I have to work constantly. There's always somebody that has more than me that I always have to work on. I'm constantly under pressure. And with the people that I'm doing business with, it's not only a practical thing, it's a competitive thing. So there's a constant pressure to produce. You see, that's the pressure from within. That would destroy the body. Okay? And but the calm person is a person that is the opposite of jealousy. The opposite of jealousy is where I evaluate the situation, what are my needs? What are my needs? And I should live by my needs. There's nothing great in this world. There's nothing that is great. Everything is practical. Okay? We really don't have great heroes. We have, because you see that the Torah tells the faults and the mistakes of the sages, that they have faults. We don't make them something like an angel, something special, you know what I mean? Something. He's a human being. He might be on a different level than me. He operates differently, but he's still a human being. He has conflicts. He has a yetzer hara, evil inclination, and he has to deal with it. Maybe at a certain point, the rarity of rarities undoes the yetzer hara completely. There's maybe one or two people that did it. But basically, it's a lifetime process, you see. But the lower it is, you see, then there's less conflict, you see. And so we look at life, we try to approach life simply from a practical point of view. And then that would be the calm life. What you have to do is evaluate your situation and what is absolutely necessary to be satisfied in your situation. If it has to do with competition that the practicality doesn't demand of you, that's where the work begins, that to start undoing that area where it's beyond the practical.